support from Rena Shulsky David and Sammy David. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, where scientists study the origin and nature of life. And a big thanks also to our listeners.
Your ears have been attuned to Eve of Disruption. And if you crave more Big Picture Science, you can find it in our archive at bigpicturescience.org.
And if you're a podcast listener, but you prefer listening to over-the-air radio because, after all, you've got a chip implanted in your liver that can pick our show from the airwaves, check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station is not on that list, consider letting them know you like the show. Oh, and do you have a comment, a criticism, or a suggestion? Well, just email them all to bigpicturescience@seti.org.
And so you're telling me that the electric banana, which you invented,
yes,
ended up in a radio studio for a while.
It did.
But yeah. It didn't make any sound, right?
No, it was completely quiet. But it was advertised every 20 minutes as the only radio station with an electrical banana, product of Caltech Research and Engineering.
You were a student at the time there?
I was, yeah. There wasn't much research or engineering, by the way.
How did you get the banana back?
I went down to the station and reclaimed it.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. Hi, I'm David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.fm is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we will be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And our guests today are Scott and Suzanne Ramsey. The Ramseys, along with Dr. Frank Thayer, are the authors of the Aztec UFO Incident. They were on the show a little over 3 years ago, and their first book on the 1948 UFO landing in Aztec, New Mexico. But since then, they have gathered new evidence to substantiate that event. Scott is a specialist in magnetic fields and wire, and is currently the vice president of sales for Express Wire Services in Charlotte, North Carolina. He's been investigating the Aztec story since 1987 and met Suzanne when he was a guest on her show, her radio show, discussing his findings. And they were ultimately married and spent years traveling at their own expense to interview witnesses and unearthing more than 55,000 documents pertaining to the incident. And we're happy to have them back on the show to share their latest findings with us. Welcome back, Scott and Suzanne.
Well, thank you, David. Thank you so much for having us. We always enjoy your show.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad you listen. And I'm glad you participate as well. So just as a refresher, give our listeners a summary of the Aztec UFO sighting and landing. Now, this wasn't a crash, was it? It was a landing. Am I right?
Yeah, from all the witness accounts that we were able to gather, the craft was virtually intact.
Mm-hmm.
For the lack of a better word, it seemed almost to make an emergency landing on that mesa back on March 25th, 1948.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's ever said they saw anything dented. There was no debris field. It was just laying at an angle on the top of a mesa. But the story pretty much starts actually several days before. There were reports of flying objects and green orbs flying over Los Alamos. And the police officer down in Cuba, New Mexico, Manuel Sandoval, and a highway patrolman by the name of Andy Andrews would meet in the evenings and compare notes. One was a little bit out of his jurisdiction, being highway patrol. His jurisdiction was just south of Bloomfield. But they had been having sightings all over that northwestern corridor of New Mexico. And on the early morning hours of the 25th, Manuel Sandoval made the decision to follow this UFO to see where it was going, or flying saucer. Really, it wasn't unidentified at all. And that led him going up the old Highway 44 toward the Farmington-Aztec-Bloomfield corridor. By his own admission, he lost it several times and then finally saw it again. And this time near Blanco, a sheep rancher was coming out right at 5 a.m., right before 5 a.m., to let his goats out and his livestock, and saw this large object. It drew attention to him because it made a sonic boom-type noise. He heard a boom and looked up, and he's got quite a large ranch there. The family still has it. And there, on the western edge of the ranch, there's a set of mesas, and the object struck the mesa. And when it did, sparks flew, and then it kind of straightened itself out and went due north, where it eventually came down in Hart Canyon. At that point, the craft is detected by some oil field workers that are responding to a brush fire out on Hart Canyon Road. And the brush fire had nothing to do with any of their drip tanks, which was their concern. But what it did drew attention to the fact that there was a big 100-foot object laying up on top of this mesa.
Okay.
So that's kind of the beginning of how the story unravels.
So you say it's the object struck the mesa?
Yes.
Do you find that was the cause of the landing slash crash or emergency landing, or
no? I think it was already in trouble. I think the object was. If you look at page 16 of the book, you can see where we went up and photographed where it hit the mesa.
Yeah.
I think the thing was out of control and in some kind of distress. And
yeah,
before it got to the mesa. Valentine Archuleta said it was kind of wobbling and floating like a leaf before it hit the mesa.
Yeah. Well, you do get reports of these UFOs, disc-type UFOs, the floating leaf or falling leaf type effect at the same time. You'd think that these guys would know to avoid hitting the mesa, and if this object can go through space, take some of the space debris, I doubt if the mesa itself would have caused
no exactly
damage.
I felt that this thing my theory, which I was going to get to later, but basically I think because these objects, or this one in particular, or one like it, was flying over Los Alamos going back as far as February, I think maybe it was shot down.
Let's see, how close to Roswell is Aztec?
Well, Roswell's in the southeastern corner of New Mexico, and Aztec is in the northwest corner.
Okay. But
so when I first started researching this, I thought, is this a confusion of the Roswell story wrapped up into another small town in the state of New Mexico? But by all indications, it's a completely separate story.
Okay. Too far away, and too far away as far as date is concerned.
Yes, it's 8 months after.
Right. Kind of close, but at the same time, far enough away to be a separate incident. Yeah,
so, exactly.
So how many witnesses were there, and how many of them were you able to personally interview?
I personally interviewed two.
Mm-hmm.
firsthand, you know, people that were actually there. Mm-hmm. Over the years, we've interviewed relatives of the people that claim they were there, and they all tell basically the same story. I mean, we don't really hear any variations. They were all very young when this happened. They were 18, 19, 20, 22 years old, with the exception of the police officers, a foreman, and a husband and wife rancher team. They were all, you know, young kids, rough oil field workers. And they all grew up to be very successful people, ironically.
Why is that ironic?
Well, yeah, I know. It almost seems like somehow they were rewarded for keeping their mouth shut.
But, kind of like Brazel in the Roswell incident, huh?
Yeah, I don't know if you know this or not. You know, besides the new truck, a few years later, he built a brand new meatpacking plant in Carrizozo.
That's Brazel from the Roswell incident.
Mm-hmm.
And he was pretty much a dirt poor farmer before the incident.
Yeah. Yeah, I've driven by his old meatpacking plant in Carrizozo twice. And before his son died, I guess that was his son's last hurrah, the family meatpacking business.
So, you hear a lot of stories about being threatened by the military to keep their mouths shut. But in some cases, maybe they say, look, we'll make it worth your while to keep your mouth shut.
When we interviewed Doug Nolan and Ken Farley, they were basically, for the lack of a better word, threatened not to talk about this incident. It was due to national security, and you won't talk to anybody about this. But everybody did awfully well.
Everybody did awfully well after that. And yet they still did talk. Did they talk about it back then?
No.
Okay.
No. I got Doug Nolan after he had a series of strokes. And matter of fact, we interviewed him by phone. Suzanne and I got married in October. We were going to fly out first week of December of 2003. And literally before we got on the plane, he passed a final stroke on him. And he said the only person he had ever told was his wife. And Ken Farley had told a longtime acquaintance of his. And we got Ken in his final stages of a lung ailment, kind of like a COPD. And we, matter of fact, we talked to him. He was on oxygen and died about a year and a half later.
Wow. So there's pretty much deathbed confessions from these people.
Yes. I mean, you know, they're definitely later on in life in their senior years and want to get the story off their chest.
Yeah. What do they have to lose, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Wow. So this story, not just these two individuals, not just in the Aztec situation, but Many people are coming forward with these deathbed confessions before they pass.
We just had one in the last 2 weeks. You know, it's Bill Steinman who wrote the second book on Aztec. He and I are very good friends. Lately, here in the last 9 months, we've been talking every day. And Bill said the best leads he ever got on his Aztec case was about a year after his book came out. And he's been very kind to share those with us. And then I was on my way to Savannah, Georgia about 2 weeks ago, and a gentleman had called the house and talked to Suzanne and was very urgently wanting to talk to me. And make a long story short, we've talked 3 or 4 times now for probably 4 hours. And he had some firsthand knowledge of Aztec. And he's 86 years old and wants it off his chest. And,
all right.
And The interesting thing was his wife, they were newlyweds back then, but he and his wife are still alive, and she can act as a verifying agent to say what he's telling you is true, and I can even add some, too. So we're checking out all his details he gave us right now, but like you say, as people get older, what do they have to lose?
That's right. That's right. And I remember, and I think I know I mentioned it on this this show before. As to the Roswell incident, what was that woman's name? I want to say Roe, one of the witnesses.
Whose father was a fireman, right?
Right, right.
Yeah, I know who you mean. Yeah. Roe.
Roe, yeah.
Yeah.
I can't remember her first name. It was kind of a funny first name.
Jackie Roe or something
like
that?
No, it was kind of an odd name. But anyway, she was an older woman. This was a few years ago. And, of course, she was like 12 years old in 47.
Mm-hmm.
And to that day, as an older woman, she was physically shaken. She had tears in her eyes because she recalled this military sergeant, mm-hmm. threatening her, saying, you know, there's a big desert out there, and nobody ever find your bones.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, that's true.
She was still physically shaken. You can imagine telling that to a small child, a 12-year-old child. Because they asked her, what did you see? And she told them, I saw these little bodies. And, no, you didn't. Well, yes, I did. Mm. No, you didn't.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So, but of course, you know, in her old age, she was coming forward with it.
Is she still alive?
I couldn't tell you that because this was about 10 years ago she was interviewed.
Mm-hmm.
And if she's listening, please notify me. You know?
Frankie Roe.
Frankie Roe. Well, Frankie is not an odd name, is it?
Well, I think for a woman it's a unique name.
Yeah, it's a unique name. I guess that's where I got the, well, that's odd for a woman, Frankie Roe. Yeah, that's right. You've been Googling it, haven't you?
No. I haven't. You know, I'll be 59 this year, but I do. When it comes to certain things and research, I have a pretty good memory.
I was going to accuse you of cheating over there.
We're at the dining room table. I'm all the way the other end of the house near from a computer.
But, I believe you. Yeah, I'll do that too. I'll say, Roe, yeah, and I can't think of the first name. And if I stop thinking about it, pops into my head.
That's exactly what I did.
Yes.
I got it off my brain, the name popped in. So.
That's it. That's the way we work.
Well, did you enjoy our rewrite of the book? We've expanded it about 33%.
I did, and the name of the book is The Aztec UFO Incident. Now, your first one was entitled Aztec, help me here.
The Aztec Incident. Recovery at Heart Canyon.
Recovery at Heart Canyon, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have that one with me, but I have your most recent one with me.
Okay.
And it's, of course, thicker than the first one. But, you know, there's plenty of information in the first one. But then you go on to expand upon that in the second one. And I was going to ask, how would you have moved that craft from that site, and to where?
Well, that was one of the last things we did before we sat down and completed the first book. Suzanne and I were having many, many conversations on that because I was actually getting challenged on that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very legitimate question for people to bring in. You know, you got a craft that's 100 feet across. You've got a tight bunch of canyons to get in and out of to get to a main road, and how are you going to do it? And just going to pause for a second and tell your listening audience, there's been several books written on Aztec. Frank Scully wrote the first one,
mm-hmm.
Behind the Flying Saucers. It came out in 1950.
Okay.
Second book was written by Bill Steinman, UFO Crash at Aztec.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very good book. It was self-published. Like our book, there's a couple little spelling errors you got to kind of get over. The third book, written by Chris Evans, Alien Conspiracy, where half the book was about Aztec.
Mm.
And then we found a fourth book that was never published. We have the original manuscript, and it was written by Richard Ogden. And he gave the manuscript to Bill Steinman before he died and said, here, do with it what you want.
Mm-hmm.
Bill found it when he moved and sent it to me last summer, and I was amazed by the book. And as Suzanne and I were planning our first book, I said, that has to be addressed. How did you get the craft out of there? We went back to Scully's book behind the flying saucers. And he addresses in the book how the scientists disassembled the craft and how it came apart in sections.
Hmm.
And taking that information, we decided to do a reenactment of moving the craft, which we did, I believe it was 2010 or 11. And we hired Bill Metzger. He's a renowned, world-renowned expert on moving large equipment, such as generators, turbines, large, huge beams, steel beams.
Mm-hmm.
And he and his wife, Pam, came out to Aztec, and we spent a week, had a good time. They're fun people. And we literally did a reenactment of moving the craft using technology from 1948, using the roads from 1948, the old oil field roads.
Right.
We did it twice. We did it forward and backward. And Bill has his report in our book on the difficulty, and basically on a 1 to 10, 10 being the most difficult, Bill said it would have been a 3. And
right.
When you have the Army Corps of Engineering or whoever helping you, I assume, moving something that would be a 3 on a 1 to 10 scale really would not be that big a deal.
Ah, I need to take a short break just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, 89.3 FM on your radio. And, of course, WHFR.FM on your computer. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. And I'm David Twitchell. We're speaking with Scott and Suzanne Ramsey and the authors of The Aztec UFO Incident. And if I could, I'd like to take a moment to talk to Suzanne on this subject.
She's right here.
Okay.
Here she is, David.
Hi, Suzanne.
Hello.
How are you?
Great.
Good, good. Yeah, we were talking about taking this this object apart. I guess you heard Scott say it was about a 3 on a scale of 1 to 10 in difficulty.
To move it.
To move it. Wow. You know, you'd think, okay, so what were the measurements? Of course, you didn't measure it, I'm sure, but by your reports, what were the measurements of this craft?
It was 100 foot across
and
about 18 feet tall.
Okay.
And there were gold rings around the center.
Mm.
And there were three floors.
Three floors.
Mm-hmm. And there was a dome on top that was a little larger than the dome on the bottom.
Mm.
So that kind of gives you a picture of what it looked like.
Yeah, that's kind of par for the course when it comes to UFO dish-shaped UFO reports.
Mm-hmm.
The dome is on the top is larger than, and then the one on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And so, how did they get into this craft?
On the day that it crashed or landed, excuse me, the oil field workers and the witnesses that were on site crawled around on top of it, looking in and trying to see. They thought originally that it was maybe one of our craft that they just had not seen or not were aware of. And so they were, in their mind, on a rescue mission.
Mm-hmm.
So they're crawling around on it, and the ranchers, the husband and wife rancher that were there, Mr. and Mrs. Knight, are yelling at them, "Get off that thing. You don't know what it is." Well, these young guys crawled all over, and it was perfectly seamless. And as they got up on top of it, they saw that there were portholes, which you were not able to see them till you got right very close to it.
Mm-hmm.
And the portholes, everything was fine, but there was one that had a hole about the size of a quarter.
Mm.
And so they tried to look through there, and they could see two slumped over bodies. And one of the oil field workers ran to his truck and grabbed a pole off of it, a wooden pole, and they poked in there in the hole, and it must have hit a lever or something because a staircase dropped down.
Mm.
So they were able to go in and, And look, they only those particular witnesses only saw the two bodies on the main floor, but there ended up being a total of 16 bodies.
16 of them.
When all of them were removed.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of gives you an idea of how it opened and how it moved.
And how did they describe the inside of the craft?
Well, there were panels, of course. There were like what we would call chairs. There were some writing and some almost like books, what we would call books. Of course, there were discs similar to what we have, like CDs or DVDs.
Hmm. I wonder if that's where we got the CDs and DVDs from.
Well, you know, that wouldn't be much of a stretch in thought, would it?
No.
When you consider the scientists that worked on this particular craft, the first batch of scientists ended up eventually owning and creating Texas Instruments. It's not much of a jump, is it?
No, not at all. Not at all. We did not have digital... what am I trying to say? Digital anything back then, did we?
No, there was nothing digital.
No.
But see, there's something, too, that I think was very interesting, and I heard Scott touch on it, and I just want to touch back onto it, something else that was kind of fascinating with the technology.
Hmm.
When Mr. Archuleta saw, Valentine Archuleta saw the craft, he was the second person to see it. When he saw it flying over his ranch, and it hit the bluff, sparks were created, and then it went due north. Once we were able to track it from where it hit that bluff to where it ended up landing, keep in mind, we say crash, but it was more of a landing because, you know, it was not in pieces, and it was settled. It was more of a landing.
Right.
And what's phenomenal to us is that it was absolutely due north from where it hit the bluff to where it landed, due north. Now, that's very unusual, and so it makes you wonder, we have no evidence of this, but it makes you wonder if it wasn't a controlled landing or if they didn't have something along the lines of an autopilot.
Mm. Very possibly. It sounds like it anyway. Okay, so what physical evidence was there at the site or elsewhere? Did you find any?
Okay, well, let's kind of walk through the process.
Okay.
The physical evidence of where it actually scraped the bluff.
Okay.
Last March, we have tried to get on and take a look at that for all these years, and there's no one that's ever documented it. And about 120 feet up on this cliff, is where it's very clear. You know, we spent almost a full day just getting up to that point and then also looking for it. And we knew that there was lots of sandstone. Have you ever been out in that area, David?
No, I'm afraid not.
Okay. For your listeners, and we use the term mesa real often, the term mesa actually means table in Spanish, tabletop. And so what it means is it's a cliff, a cliff or a bluff that's pretty flat on the top.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where it ended up landing. But the cliffs and the bluffs where we found the scrape mark, we had to look for something that would be not sandstone. Well, there's a lot of sandstone there because sandstone scraping with a metal would not create sparks. Well, we were able to finally find volcanic rock and trace it down, and so we found the scrape. And that was a big breakthrough. We were really very excited about that.
Mm.
Once you get to the actual site itself, through interviewing witnesses and people that worked on the craft, either on location or elsewhere, one of the things that we were told from one of the military people, you'll know when you find the location because there will be a road that seems to go nowhere. And then you'll also find a cement slab out there in the middle of the desert on top of a mesa.
Hmm.
And we were certain that we had the right area, but we didn't see a slab, a cement slab. And so a friend of ours from Farmington went, Randy Barnes, and poked with a rod till he found it, and he did find it. And so it was dug out, and we did have core samples taken of it to find out and date it and things. So that's another piece of evidence. And the reason for the road was that they had to be able to get in close enough. Well, if you're familiar, again, with that area, it's very remote and pretty desolate, a lot of sand, pinyon trees, cactus, things like that out there, and sagebrush, lots of sagebrush, and then cliffs, bluffs, and pretty rugged area. If you were going to try and get into that area where it had landed on top, you would have to have some type of a way, aside from the road that was existing, to get in there. So they created a road, and it was not any place on any map, and that's an oil-filled area, so every single road is well-documented. That wasn't. And then just adjacent to that road that seemed to go nowhere was the cement slab, and the military person that we worked with that had worked on the craft, he said that the cement slab was used for the crane. Because of the silty ground in that area, it's very difficult to use a very large crane to move something. It kept slipping, and so they had to create something to give it, you know, make
traction,
it steady.
Yeah.
And so there again, we were concerned. Initially, we had skeptics and things say, well, it's a cap for an oil well. Well, I can tell you, we wouldn't be sitting here right now if, after digging a hole into it, if it was a cap for an oil well. No, it just wouldn't be. And we've had oil field experts go out and take a look at it, and they didn't know why we were there. We just said, what would you say that this is for? And they said, nothing in our field. You know, nothing that would pertain to us.
Okay, so, you say you had this guy was poking around. Did it appear that this cement slab had been covered up with earth?
Yes, but some of that is going to be from weather conditions,
right,
and things. You know, but yes, it was covered up. That's why we weren't able to see it. But he was poking around in the ground, and it's silty enough that he was able to, with something firm, find it. You know, or at least start to
right.
find it.
Right. So, what was unique about the Aztec crash as opposed to other UFO crashes that have been reported?
Oh, my gosh. I get really, really excited when I even think about that, because I think, you know, each case has its own merits and its own, you know, interesting pieces to it. But the beauty of the Aztec incident is, and I'm honored to say that we were able to have the enjoyment of documenting it, is that it is a full and a complete story. A lot of times you'll have somebody have an experience or a sighting or, you know, an abduction or whatever, or physical evidence, but you don't have all of the pieces together.
Yeah.
And as Scott described earlier, starting with pre-crash landing, you know, for some time before that, there was documentation at Los Alamos, then Cuba, New Mexico. Then the officer following it up, and then the amount of witnesses. And the witnesses at the crash site were a county commissioner, a city councilman. There is, after the fact, there was a minister that came and said prayers over the bodies. There's, you know, ranchers, there's oil field workers. You know, these are all, you know, highly regarded people, very sound people. So you have that. Then you have the witnesses followed up by the fact that we were able to track down who some of the scientists that actually worked on this were. And that's something that often is not covered.
Wow.
And after that, we were able to document how it was covered up. You know that term conspiracy and cover up? Mm-hmm. Honestly, it gets overused, and a lot of times the impact of that term, those terms, is diluted.
Right.
And but in this case, those are very accurate terms,
mm-hmm.
because we can document with documentation what went down and how it was covered up and how it was professed to be a hoax, how that came into place. And I want to address that for a moment, too. If you look on the Internet, about 50% of the time you'll see the term hoax associated with this.
Hmm.
And you'll see it always associated with people that did not thoroughly investigate.
Right.
If you do any type of research or investigation and you only do it halfway through or you've never been there,
right.
it's very difficult to give it a full assessment.
Right.
And so it gets me so excited to even think about it, that this is a complete story. It's not, you know, there are things, of course, that we wish that we could find out and we have not yet found out. You know, we don't have pictures.
Mm.
We don't, you know, there are things that we would love to have. We'd love to have the craft. We'd love to have the body.
Oh, yeah.
But there's so many other things that we're able to document. That's really exciting.
Where do you think they took this craft or pieces thereof?
Well, that's kind of some information that we're working on right now.
Ah.
As Scott said, we've recently got some information, and we could have, given you an educated guess, but we really don't like to do that. And in the book, we try to put as much as we can that's factual and documentable.
Okay.
But,
okay.
In this
so.
Case,
Let's just tell our listeners the following is not fact, but an educated guess. Where?
I really hate to even say because I can't give you facts on that, and so until we're able to do that, I just as soon hold off on that. But hopefully, here we thought we were about done.
Yeah.
We thought, well, we've gotten everything we can, and then we had new information like. That's had brought to us, and so on several avenues. So hopefully I'll be able to tell you that the next time we talk. But.
Okay. All right. I need to take one more break to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, 89.3 FM. And you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with Scott and Suzanne Ramsey, authors and researchers and authors of the book, The Aztec UFO Incident. I also wanted to remind our listeners, and this will be the last opportunity that I can remind you of this, and maybe some of you are saying, oh, that's good that this is the last one. The Swamp Gas UFO Convention will be held very shortly here on March 19th, Saturday, March 19th, at the Wyndham Gardens Hotel in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Now, Michigan chapter of the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON, is putting this on, and we're going to have Peter Robbins and Grant Cameron as the main speakers, but there are going to be a lot of other speakers. Going to start at 10 in the morning, go to 7 at night, and we're going to break for lunch, and it's going to be an affair. So if you're in the Michigan area, or if you can get in the Michigan area, March 19th, Saturday, March 19th, for the Swamp Gas UFO Conference, you can go to swampgasufo.com. That's all one word, of course, swampgasufo.com. For details, and they're not really tickets, but they're a will call, but you can reserve your will call tickets there. So remember, Saturday, March 19th, it's going to be a UFO affair. So swampgasufo.com. Right now, we're going to get back to Scott and Suzanne Ramsey. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And what were we talking about? We were talking about the fact that there are so many, so much evidence that you've uncovered, and you refuse to tell me where you think this thing is. And I can't worm it out of you, but what can I say? I'm terrible.
You are.
I am. You love it, don't you?
That's right.
Of course.
And so am I, and that's why you love it, too.
That's it. Peas in a pod there.
That's right.
Now, you say, now, either you or Scott can answer this, but you say that you have collected about 55,000 documents referring to the incident. From where did you get all these documents?
I'm going to let you ask Scott that question.
All right.
Hello, I'm back.
Okay. Yeah, where did you get all these 55,000 documents?
Well, I want to make it clear, all 55,000 documents are a lot of supportive evidence.
Mm-hmm.
And there's many more than 55,000. I think we've added 1,000 in the last couple of months. Basically what they are, if somebody says, well, I lived in Aztec at the time and worked for XYZ Oil Company,
mm-hmm.
You know, we go and we pull the real estate records to make sure that this person lived there. Personnel records out in the oil field are getting more and more difficult to get because, A, the time frame, and, B, there's been so many mergers and acquisitions.
Hmm.
But what we can get, we consider that supporting a document. On the flip side of which ones really have a lot of meat, I wish we could put more in the book, but unfortunately we don't control that aspect. The publisher does. We've done a lot of Freedom of Information Acts with the Air Force, Army Central Intelligence Division, CIA, FBI. I think I did say the Air Force. That's the most important one.
Mm.
And we have thousands of those documents.
Wow. The Air Force?
We have all the files on Leo Gebauer, Silas Newton, that were key players in the original Scully era of Behind the Flying Saucers.
Mm.
And it's overwhelming. And one of these days, if we ever have a real winter down here, on a cold winter, we'll sit down and start organizing them, because right now they're just all kind of in file boxes.
Hmm.
But it's interesting. I mean, if somebody says, well, I don't believe so-and-so worked there at the time, I can go and pull a record and say, well, here it is. Or, you know, somebody lived in Aztec or Farmington at the time, we say, well, here's the real estate transaction records. They really did.
So did you say the Air Force had documents on this?
The Air Force still has documents on it. They don't give us everything. We've been denied historical reports over the years. They're actually very wonderful to work with.
Mm.
But, you know, it's the law of sources, methods, and means. If there's something in that report that would be a source, a method, or a means they use today, they can deny it.
Yeah. Okay, so when you say they have denied you a certain documents pertaining to this Aztec crash, and I call it a crash, landing,
yeah.
Whatever.
Mm-hmm.
When you say you have been denied it, they haven't said, we don't have anything on that. They have denied it.
Yeah, we actually have documents that have the word Aztec flying saucer on them.
From the Air Force.
Mm-hmm. And we got them from the FBI and the Army CID. Of course, at the end of the day, their conclusions are, oh, the thing was a big hoax. And my question is, you guys are a pretty smart group of intelligence people. Why would you follow a case for many years before deciding it was a hoax? And I don't know if you read the part in the book about the sting operation that they had in downtown Denver to try to recover black and white photos, and in their words, not mine, of the Aztec flying saucer. I think, you know, anytime there's a little bit of smoke, there's probably a little bit of fire.
It would seem like all they'd have to do is when they got this quote-unquote hoaxed report of a crashed disc out there in a certain area, all they'd have to do is go out there and look. They don't see it. Now it's a hoax.
Mm-hmm.
Why keep following the trail for years, huh?
The FBI, by their own admission, kept a file on Silas Newton until he died in 1974.
Kept a file on whom?
Silas Newton. He was one of Scully's original confidants on the whole Aztec crash.
Mm. So they kept track of him, huh?
Yeah, and he had been in and out of the law over his career. I won't deny that, but it seems like, you know, once he got on their list, they kept pretty good tabs of him. my whole contention all along, and I could prove it if just by laying out some papers, I don't think the Air Force was as upset about the story leaking about Aztec. They can always cover that up.
Yeah.
I think they were more interested in who leaked the story to Frank Scully.
Hmm.
Not the what, but the who.
Mm-hmm. They couldn't buy this guy off, huh?
Well, I think there was more than one. I think that whole group of scientists that Scully refers to as Dr. G, that was where the government had a concern. They were trying to figure out what group of scientists do we have that worked on top-shelf projects during World War II are leaking things to certain people and certain journalists.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so this Frank Scully, who exactly was he and or is he? I guess it's a was he, right?
Yeah, he's passed. Yeah, he died in the early 60s.
And why do you think he broke that story? Was it to make money?
In his own words, in his book, he broke the story because the scientists convinced him that the story would break on its own, and they wanted Scully to be the first one to break it.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, I think Scully admits that there was no intention ever for the scientists and the government to break the story.
No.
But he felt that he had these people coming to him and telling him the most credible story. They were of very credible means that he had to run with the story.
Yeah. Was Scully a reporter or author? Or?
Journalist, yeah.
Journalist.
A little bit of both.
Yeah, a little bit of both. Yeah. Aren't they all? if they're a reporter, they want to write that great American novel.
Yeah. Well, Frank Scully's book on Aztec was actually the first hardback book ever written on flying saucers back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Tom Kehoe beat him by... Donald Kehoe beat him by a month or two with a paperback, but Scully was the first hardback book on the subject.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about the scientists that you've tracked down and that worked on the craft, and what exactly are their credentials?
Well, I don't know where to start there. Bill Steinman, in his book, put down that he thought Carl Hyland from Denver, Colorado, was the main Dr. G. These scientists that approached Scully, he gave them a blanket name of Dr. G.
Mm-hmm.
In our first book, we were convinced it was Jonathan Torrance Tate from the University of Minnesota. And the more I spent time with Bill Steinman this past year, both personally and on the phone, I have to lean a little bit toward Bill Steinman's finding that it was... Highland out of Denver, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And that Tate certainly, both Steinman and I agree that Tate definitely was on the team. But in things that were told to Scully were more in the palm of the hands of Carl Highland. Both died relatively short time after the book came out. Scully's book came out September 1950. Tate died September 1950. And the other gentleman died, Highland died in 1956.
Mm-hmm.
And Peacock died in 1950 or 49. And then some lasted all the way into the year 2000.
Mm-hmm.
But these scientists all worked for OSRD during World War II. And they worked for Vannevar Bush.
Uh-huh.
And OSRD, of course, had many interesting projects, including the Manhattan Project attached to it.
Mm-hmm.
And Scully goes on to describe how they had worked on a very top-secret program during World War II and gave a description of the projects they worked on. And then we took that and matched it up to the scientists back in that era that was assigned to those projects by Vannevar Bush.
Mm-hmm.
And they all had very impressive resumes, and seven of them went on to form GSI, which doesn't mean anything to your listening audience, but years later when it went public, it became Texas Instruments.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And wasn't Bush allegedly part of the original Majestic 12?
Yes, he has been named as a member of the original, you know, six civilians, six scientists, Majestic 12. That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And for those of our listeners that don't know about Majestic 12, they are the the privileged few that originally they said, okay, here we have this crash disk. Make something of it. What's going on?
Yeah, figure it out.
Yeah, figure it out, and then we'll tell the public, right?
Mm-hmm.
When we have a handle on it, when we're in control. And that's why we have these covert radio shows.
Well, the gentleman that just recently contacted us, 1958 to 1960, he said they still, and he is adamant that the saucer he is talking about is the one recovered from Aztec. And time will tell. I mean, there's a lot of research going to be done to find out if everything lines up in the story. So far, after almost 2 weeks, his story is being confirmed. However, in 58 to 1960, he said not all of the Aztec crash had been figured out. He said they were far from it.
Hmm. What's to figure out? The thing crashed. They had the bombs.
Well, how it operated and all the capabilities.
Oh, I see
it.
What you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah,
okay. Yeah, well, probably same with Roswell. You know, they have all this stuff, and, you know, what does it do? Let's back engineer it.
Yeah.
And in some cases, they have back engineered it.
Mm-hmm.
And in others, they're still scratching their head.
Well, to quote Stan Friedman in Steel Line, he always said, you know, if you took the latest class nuke submarine and gave it to Christopher Columbus, it wouldn't mean anything for him.
Right. That's right.
And I think, you know, we're possibly in that same boat.
I'm afraid you're right. Mm-hmm. I always say I don't think we could, human brains could wrap themselves around the real truth and what exactly is going on, and the laws of physics that have been discovered by more advanced civilizations.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's against the known laws of physics. Yes, the known laws of physics.
Right.
What we know.
Well, the other way to look at it, just look in our lifetime, how technology has gone just insane. If these things are from another part of our universe,
mm-hmm.
they don't have to be 1,000 years ahead of us.
No.
They could be 100 years ahead of us. They could be 200 years ahead of us. It could be 50 years ahead of us. Think we're going to be in 50 years.
That's right. Well, look back 50 years. Look back,
yep.
100 years.
And I can do that at my age.
100 years?
50.
Oh, I thought, I just got through saying, look back 100 years. You said I can do that.
I've been researching this. We're now on our 30th year.
Okay.
And, you know, every time we think we're going to slow down, then we get an exciting lead like the one we just had.
Yeah, yeah. Now, Suzanne was talking about some of the things that they found in the craft, things like discs, CDs, and writings. I assume there were symbols. Of course, I always say, well, you know, our alphabet is nothing but symbols.
That's right.
So, and a lot of people, like the Roswell incident, every crash where they find UFOs or every abductee seems to report seeing these symbols that they equate to hieroglyphics.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the case in the Aztec crash?
To somewhat. Bill Steinman did far more research in that than we did from some of the people that he interviewed, and quite frankly, that never made it into his book.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Bill has a big file on what the hieroglyphics supposedly looked like.
Mm-hmm.
more so than probably people we interviewed. These young oil field workers kind of stuck their head up where the staircase came down, and they were climbing all over the thing, but nobody physically went all the way inside.
They didn't?
No.
Why not?
I don't know. I think they had some adults that were screaming bloody murder at them to stay out of it. And they're young kids and kind of cocky by their own admission.
Herbert, get out of there.
That's right.
That
contraption. Yeah, like Suzanne had said, at first, you know, Doug Nolan's words were, you know, we thought this was a rescue mission. We thought this was one of ours.
Yeah. Well, you say they retrieved 16 bodies from that craft.
Mm-hmm.
How did they get them out if they didn't go in?
They were taken out after the military got there.
Oh, so the military went in and...
Yeah. Later in the day... Later in the morning, I should say, Solon Leamy Brown was a Baptist minister from Mancos, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And he probably was there the latest. I'm assuming that. I don't know that for a fact. But at one point, he was asked to say a prayer over the little beings, which, you know, it's not last rites. He's a Baptist minister. But... You know, we got this all from Walt Sayer, and who was a young man that his father was a deacon for the Mancos Baptist Church. And after Solon Brown came back from the crash site, he gathered his most trusted people together and told them about what had happened down in Aztec. And, you know, some of the young guys we interviewed, some say it was 12, some say it was 14. I think it's all down to what time you were there. Before you were disbanded and sworn to secrecy and sent on your way.
Uh-huh. Well, it's very similar to the Roswell crash where they told them all to keep quiet.
Yep.
But this saying a prayer, having the minister come out, is reminiscent of the case in Texas, and I'm not going to tell you the town because I can't remember. It'll come to you.
Aurora.
Aurora, yeah, indeed, where it took out the windmill.
Yeah.
And they found the little body and had the minister come out. And they buried this little guy. And I guess it was UFO hunters that went out there. And they found the grave. And they couldn't exhume the body. But sonar told them that something was down there. And they went away, came back the next day. The grave had been dug up, and it was empty.
Yeah.
Gee, I wonder who could have done such a thing.
Jim Mars did an incredible investigation on that back in 97. Have you ever had him on your show?
Mars?
Yeah.
No.
He's really interesting. He did a lot of research on that incident.
Did you say Jim Mars?
Yeah, M-A-R-R-S.
I'm writing this down. Thank you for the tip. You got his email address?
But email me privately, and I'll give you his contact information.
I wasn't going to ask for it right here, but I would edit that out, and I don't edit my show.
There you go. Hey, before I forget, I want to thank you. You're one of the first people that ever interviewed me years ago.
Really? For the TV version?
No, for radio.
For radio.
It was at one of the conferences. You interviewed me for, and we did the radio show, you taped the radio show in the Marriott lobby.
No, that was the TV version.
Oh, was that TV?
That was TV.
Oh, you have a good memory. I figured that's I don't show up on many radar screens, so I,
yeah.
You know.
Well, that's good.
You were kind enough to always have an interest in our work, and Suzanne and I appreciate that.
Ah, no problem. And, I assume you're going to continue with your investigations?
We weren't until that phone call 2 weeks ago.
Doggone it, new information. Here we go back to work again, right?
I shared it with Frank Thayer in great detail and Bill Steinman, and both are sitting at their typewriters writing a new book.
So where can our listeners go to check out your work?
If you'd like a signed copy by Suzanne and I, you can go to www.theaztecincident.com.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a website. Go on there. We'll sign it personally, take it to the mailbox, and drop it off. If you just don't need a signed version, you can go to Amazon.com, and you can go to BarnesandNoble.com, their online version, or go to your local Barnes & Noble store. They should have a copy.
Scott and Suzanne Ramsey, thank you so much for joining us today. We will do it again.
Thanks, David. You have a good day.
Okay, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived on my website, which is ufoimplications.com. So please stay tuned to WHFR.FM, the station making waves for the best in alternative programming. And I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. And until then, as always, this is Dave Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky. You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. Yo, guys and dolls out there. Hey, you're at the Malt Shop with Daddy G here on WHFR. And we're going back to the 50s and the 60s again today. So hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the Malt Shop. I'll be playing the platters and you'll be doing the dancing, okay? So, here we are, back in the 50s.
Well, it's one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready. Now go, cat, go, but don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but step over my blue suede shoe. Well, you can knock me down, step in my face, slander my name all over the place. Well, do anything that you want to do, but not, honey, lay off them shoes. And don't you step on my blue suede shoe. Well, you can do anything but take me over my blue suede shoes. Let's go, cat! Oh, what you doing? Well, you can burn my house, steal my car, drink my liquor,